Do you drink locally? That is, if you're hankering for a beer, some wine, or even some hard liquor, do you look for local offerings first? If so, the selections have grown by leaps and bounds over the last couple decades in Wisconsin. This hour, we'll talk with three people in the local winemaking, brewing, and distilling business to get a sense of what is pushing the movement and what got them to join the ranks of the suppliers in western Wisconsin, and what some of the challenges they faced early on were for local breweries, wineries, and distilleries. We're talking about drinking locally this hour on the West Side. I'm Rich Kramer. Thanks for joining us this Monday morning. My guests for this hour are all from western Wisconsin, are currently residing there, and you may have seen or even sampled some of their products. First, I'd like to welcome Lausch Frank. He's the co-owner and brewmaster for Lazy Monk Brewing here, right here in Eau Claire. Lausch, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
It's our pleasure. Next, I'd like to welcome Joe Winimko. He's co-owner and head vintner for O'Neill Creek Winery in Bloomer. Joe, thanks for being here.
Morning.
Morning. And finally, I'd like to welcome Paul Werney. Paul is a co-owner and head distiller, I guess, of 45th Parallel Distillery in New Richmond. Paul, thanks so much for being here.
Good to be here.
Good to have you. And listeners, we'd like to hear from you. Do you drink locally, or do you go for the big national brands? Give us a call and let us know why. The number is 1-800-228-5615. You can also leave a question or a comment on our Westside Facebook page. Again, the number 1-800-228-5615. And it seems like, I'm going to go round robin with you, gentlemen. It seems like everywhere you look, there are more and more local wineries, brew pubs, and even distilleries, which have kind of come up recently. And Lausch, I'll start with you. Why do you think this local craft beverage movement has become so popular?
I think it became to be that people are looking for more flavors than what major producers of the food or beer are offering. And we, in a craft industry, craft beer, we are trying to fill that niche.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a lot of different beers out there, not necessarily from Wisconsin. So is there a different reason, you think, for the craft brewers in Wisconsin becoming so popular? Does it go beyond flavor at all?
Probably also it goes beyond drinking locally and consuming local foods. I think that the whole movement of buying locally and consuming locally started maybe 10 years ago, and it's just continuing.
Yeah, it seems to be growing, I mean, very quickly. And Joe Winimko, winemaking is not new to Wisconsin. It's been around for quite a long time. But, again, in the last maybe 10, 20 years, we've seen a lot of smaller producers joining the ranks. What do you think is pushing that?
Well, I think every winery has its own personality, its own ambiance. So when people are wine hopping or checking wineries out, they get a new experience each time. Not only us, but you have Rivers Bend and Autumn Harvest. Mm-hmm. So they go each one of those, and they're going to get a different experience, different wines. So it's a unique experience that the local wineries bring to the table, and people enjoy that. You know, if it's, you know, watching nature or listen to music, mm-hmm. or just relaxing, you know. So like I says, each winery has its own personality, own ambiance, and I think the people enjoy that, you know, afternoon out.
Very good. And Paul Werney, with spirits coming into the fold here locally, that is, I mean, we've got the big national brands that we've had forever, that our parents, grandparents might have used. What is causing local distilleries to become more popular?
Well, I think it has a lot to do with a new generation of a consumer. Over the past 20 years, you have young people that have grown up with small beers and small wines. Mm-hmm. And the breweries and the wineries are getting much better at what they're doing. So the beers, at one time, were considered, you know, relatively unappealing in the United States. But now the United States makes the best beers in the world. Same with wine. So now that they look at distilleries the same way, maybe we can get the good distilled spirits here in the United States also. So we have a whole generation of young consumers that's what they're looking for.
Very good. All right. Well, beer seemed to be leading the charge, and I remember even talking with Paul a while back, and he said that distilleries are kind of 20 years behind the local craft brewing experiences. So, Lausch, I'm going to start with you, and we're going to talk about brews first. Again, we're talking about drinking locally, local beer, wine, and spirits available here in western Wisconsin. We've got three of the people who make it for you right here in the studio. The number to call in, 1-800-228-5615. That number again, 1-800-228-5615. So first off, how do we define a brewery, Lausch?
The brewery is anybody, or beer is defined anybody who is making a product that contains malt, hops, yeast, and water. You can have some adjuncts to it too, but you need to have a hops as you would have a beer. That's defined by federal government.
Right, and sold commercially also.
Yes,
that's the technical definition.
Yes.
A lot of people do homebrew. We'll get into that in just a bit. But I did a quick search, very basic search this morning, and I found just offhand 122 local breweries, but many of these are relatively new. Any idea when Wisconsin's microbrew market really started taking off?
I think that actually the known names right now would be New Glarus, Lakefront, and probably Capital. Those would be the first people who came and started to, and that was about 20 years ago.
We're still talking just 20 years ago.
Yes.
And so what got you into the game?
It wasn't as poetic. I got laid off from a job, and I was working in IT industry, and I didn't want to relocate. And I had this hobby, and so I have this hobby, and I guess probably we could do that right now. So we opened a microbrewery here in Eau Claire, and I have to say it's been a lot of work, but it has a lot of other rewards. That makes it worth it.
You know, you're the second person that I know that I've met that's gotten into the alcohol business after being in IT. And I imagine that would be a little a kind of a hectic switch. So you said it had been a hobby. How long have you been making beer at home then?
I started in 2008, and I became to be fairly interested in it. I was very interested in process, how to do that. And I was brewing quite extensively, and all my neighbors were very happy from rewards of the labor because I couldn't really consume all the beer. And what it is it's like a cooking, you know. So you make the product, you make the thing, and then you want to share. And the process was interesting, so it wasn't just simple, you know, you do X, Y, Z, and that you are done. Actually, there is multiple steps, and you need to understand it. So it began to be as a hobby, and it turned out to be more than just a hobby.
So you had this hobby, but why not try to get another job in IT? What made you say, well, I think I'll start my own business and in this market that is, you know, there's a lot of other local breweries around.
The job what I had, I worked with a lot of data. I was a database developer, and there wasn't in local area, there wasn't another at that time another business which had so much data for me to work. If I would want to travel and go to Minneapolis, probably I could get a job, but I really didn't want to travel.
Mm-hmm. So again, I mean, what kind of discussions happened at home as far as, because I talked to your wife before you came on, and she mentioned that this she kind of thinks of this all as a midlife crisis kind of a thing.
Yes. There is still reference that if I would purchase that red Corvette, it would have been cheaper and much less work. And the only decision would be red or yellow. I guess, you know, I never had a business before, and it was more, every home brewer has a dream and has a dream to open a brewery, even though those dreams are, most of them, they will never actually realize or materialize. So It was, you know, laying in a bed in a night and thinking that if it's viable or if it's not viable, and then if it's viable, on what scales it is viable. And, of course, business runs on money. You know, do you have that money to start with?
Right. Did you have to seek out investors, or did you were able to finance yourself?
We financed ourselves. We do not have loans. We do not have investors.
Wow. That's got to be – that's one set of challenges kind of off to the side then. So what were some of the other things that came up, you know, early on that you might not have expected or that might have been more difficult than expected?
Yes. The making beer was the easy part as a home brewer.
Even though the scale had changed?
It was a little challenge, but I'd say the biggest challenge was to sell our beer because to make people know that you have a product they might enjoy. And that is the biggest challenge on you know, you don't have $1 million for advertising budget. Mm-hmm. And so you need to go and you need to do tasting and you need to talk about what you have. And at some point we opened a tap room, and the tap room had been very successful with introducing other people to our product.
Okay.
And then we have a lot of people, a lot of return customers because they enjoy ambiance. And what we offer them. We control the whole experience of people consuming our beer. The tap room is not just for a beer drinker. It's a family environment. We do not have TVs. We don't have loud music. You know, people can bring their kids there. We have a root beer for them. A lot of people, they, you know, you don't have TVs. There are no distractions. So they enjoy themselves. They talk, you know, kind of concept, talking.
So no TV inside an establishment that sells beer. That's a very wild concept, I think, compared to what we normally see.
Yes, I think that we created like a little Cheers,
sure,
you know, over there, and that's what people enjoy going there.
What about getting people to know that you have this product is definitely, it sounds like it would be a task. What about the laws? Are there any kind of... When you had to deal with, I imagine you have to deal with inspections maybe once in a while. And
yes.
Walk us through that, if you would.
Well, there is the alcohol or beer industry is heavily regulated, and it has a difficult sides as well as it has a good sides. And yes, you are a food producer, so you are you need to follow all the health. Regulations and of food production, as well as then you are producing excess tax products, so you need to file all these reports and you need to be actually approved because it's a privilege to make alcoholic beverage.
Right, as far as recipes, where do you get your recipes? I mean, you've been tinkering with it for a while.
Yes, but, as a home brewer.
But you have a formula that you follow for certain, because I noticed you had a Baltic
porter.
A porter.
Yes.
So that's kind of a traditional kind of a drink.
We do mostly traditional. I come from Europe, so that's why our year-round beers, they are beers what you find in Czech Republic or Slovak Republic. And then other seasonals, they are mostly around Germany and Eastern Europe. So Baltic porter is really the porter which is coming from a Baltic Sea region. Recipes are not the secrets for home brewers, so people exchange the recipes. How I went on it, I tried to study how the beer was made originally in that region, mm-hmm. and then I went from it and I brewed some test batches and picked up the suppliers and grain.
So where does that come from? I mean, do you get any of your products? Because I know that Wisconsin, there's a hops exchange that I've
yes.
heard a lot about. And so are you getting the raw ingredients from locally here in the region or from the state?
I buy them in Minnesota, but most of the stuff is actually imported. It goes back to my wife, she wanted to make chocolate chip cookies for my parents in Europe. So she brought chocolate chips because they are not chocolate chips. But she used local flour and local sugar and local butter. And when she made it, it wasn't chocolate chip cookies. So the same idea is, if I want to make Czecho-German beers, I need to take Czecho-German ingredients, because local grain, even though it's good grain, it is not necessarily suitable, at least in my opinion, for the beers what I am making. Recently, I bought a hops from Wisconsin Hops Exchange, and I will be making some American beers. So at that time, I will use the barley grown in the United States.
Okay. What kind of competition is there out there? Or is it not really – do you not see it in terms of competition? Because we've got Northwoods Brew Pub. We've got a number of others I can't even think of right now, just in the Eau Claire area.
Yes.
So what's that like? I mean, is the market kind of saturated, and is it tough to get a start?
If you go to grocery stores, market is saturated. If you try to get into bars, market is saturated. And that's what, when we opened a tap room, we really didn't think that it's going to be main driver of our sales. And it turned out to be that because you control the experience, you actually control what you sell, you move your product. So that is probably the easiest way how you can move your product. You do it by yourself. So yes, it is saturated, but different breweries have different models, and they try to follow that path.
A reminder for our listeners, we're talking about drinking locally. We've got three men involved in the local production of beer, wine, and spirits. The number to call in, 1-800-228-5615. That number again, 1-800-228-5615. What do you drink? Do you go for the Miller, the Coors, the Busch, or do you go for a tasty local beer? And why? Why do you pick one or the other? Let us know, 800-228-5615. What kind of volume do you do at Lazy Monk? You say it's mostly through the tap room. That seems to be the venue.
Actually, there are two things because tap room has a high margin, so we get more sales per smaller amount of the volume.
Okay.
Still, the most volume actually goes through the distributor. Well, distributor through the we are sell distributors through the grocery stores, liquor stores, and bars.
Okay. Any numbers? I mean, how many bottles a year, or how do you measure?
It's measured in barrels. One barrel is 31 gallons, and last year we sold we made 312 barrels.
That's fair.
It's still small.
Well, you mentioned your self distributors.
Yes.
I thought there was a couple. I wish I had more specifics, but there was a law introduced, and some say it was introduced by the Miller, Coors, the national brewers, to kind of restrict that. And were you part of fighting against that, or did that pass?
Yes, it did pass. What is very important for me as I can be self distributor. They tried to limit that brewery's own distributions.
Yeah.
That was the main reason. For self-distributor, they actually raised the cap from 60,000 barrels to 300,000 barrels. So I don't think that
You're not gonna be.
Not anytime soon.
Okay. Well, we do have a call, but we're going to take a quick break. We'll be back in just a bit to talk more about drinking locally. I'm joined by Lausch Frank. He's the head brewer and co-owner of Lazy Monk Brewing in Eau Claire. We'll also speak with Joe Winemko, vintner and co-owner of O'Neill Creek Winery in Bloomer, and Paul Werney, co-owner and head distiller at 45th Parallel Distillery in New Richmond. This is the West Side. We'll be back in 30 seconds. I'm Rich Kramer, and you're listening to The West Side on Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking about imbibing locally, local beer, local wine, local spirits. Why the resurgence in Wisconsin? And what do you like? Do you prefer a national brand, or do you go local? And if so, why? Give us a call, 800-228-5615. We've got the first caller of the morning on the program, and we're going to go to Chippewa Falls. And Noel, you're on the program. Thanks for calling in.
Thanks for taking my call. I was wondering if the guy from O'Neill Creek Brewery or Winery could talk more about his operation, his hours, and a list of some of the different types of wines and talk about the different types of wines.
Sure, we can do that. We're going to go right to him right now. So thanks a lot for the call, Noel.
Thank you. I'll listen.
All right. Very good. Thanks so much. And with that, you know, beer kind of made the most news, and a lot of brewers got involved. But winemaking goes back a long ways in Wisconsin. In fact, there's a wiswine.com that I was looking at that mentioned this, I think it was a Hungarian person who came in and set up the first winery back in like 1849 in Wisconsin and moved on. But so Joe Winemko, why has local winemaking come back so hard when people can just make it at home? Why are they looking to distribute or to winemakers like you?
Well, I think it's just the ambiance of a winery. You know, going back to relaxing atmosphere and stuff like that, and the products are getting better. When you get into the profession and stuff, you get resources that you keep improving your product, and the customers drive that too, as far as tasting. And I think it's just the ambiance of a winery. You know, each one is different.
So tell us about what it's like for you guys. Are the winery itself? I mean, it's your home basically, isn't it?
Yep, we live upstairs, and we just can tumble downstairs, and the winery's there. We got a gift shop, and the production room's down there too. So
tell me, how did you get into winemaking, and where did O'Neill Creek Winery get its start?
Well, it started quite a few years back. My children got me a wine startup kit, and I start playing around with it.
No kidding.
Just, I think a lot of stories in wineries are started that way. From there, just played with recipes and stuff, and people seemed to like like what I produced. So I figured. Well, there was Timber Ridge Winery, John Gill, down by Blair. He was kind of my mentor.
Mm-hmm.
So I tumbled down there after work, and he helped me with figuring out the paperwork, and I helped him bottle and all the processes of fermentation and where you go. So I figured, yeah, that's okay. So I liked the way his setup was. So when I retired, I went built with the winery in mind, so we're on a plateau when we have a walk-in, and we live upstairs.
Hmm.
So,
what kind of so you were making wines? The home wine kit, I love that. I mean, that's about as basic a start as you can get. So you caught the bug, then you got into production. I mean, where did you start out as far as volume?
Well, we opened in 2009 with about 800 bottles, cases. 12 bottles is about 2.37 gallons. So with 800 bottles, and we went from there, and it's been expanding ever since. Right now we're over 6,000 bottles and in 14 retail stores. It's growing quite a bit.
6,000 bottles, that's... And all those bottled by hand then? By your hand?
We have a bottling machine, but I'm still working towards a corker. So my brother-in-law kind of does that deed there with the hand corker and stuff. So it's working now, but because of the volume getting up there, I'm going to have to find more... mechanical items.
Sure, some more mechanical help.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of tradition involved with beer, wine, or spirits, and we spoke with Lausche a little bit about that. But for wine, I imagine the tradition is especially strong. Your wine is a little different than what most people might think of as wine because you're sans grapes. No grapes involved, right?
That's right. I do all fruit and specialty wines all the way from, I got everybody's grandma made it, Summer Delight, it's our dandelion wine with a little lime and orange, all the way to beet wine.
Hmm.
We have 15 wines right now, and we have some new releases coming up. I do fruit and specialty wines. I found my niche in that. And
why?
I feel comfortable with it. That's what my mother made way back when is, you know, home home wines, dandelion wine. So from there, you know, you figure out your recipes and stuff like that and go from there. I just feel comfortable with it. And I majority of the product that goes into our wine is grown on our property, except for blueberries and cranberries. So all Wisconsin fruits, and it's been successful. It's grown quite a bit.
Is there any difference in how you make fruit wine versus grape wine?
No. Fermentation. You know, that's, you know, you get the yeast eating the sugar and to make the alcohol. Everybody has a misconception, and there was an article in the one Madison paper there about fruity wines.
Mm-hmm.
Well, fermentation, yeah, you got the aroma of the fruit, but you can have a dry fruit wine, you can have a semi, you can have a sweet fruit wine. Mm-hmm. There's people come in, they know what they're coming to with our website and stuff like that, that says, well, I don't like fruity wines. I says, what's a grape?
Yeah, it's...
So it's sure. It's a fruit, you know. So I get a little fun out of that, you know. Don't want to hurt their feelings or anything, but Wisconsin has some fantastic wines, and I, you know, everybody thinks California, kind of California when they go into a place to buy wines and stuff like that, but Wisconsin has some fantastic wines out there. And we're working that way, even the local level, as far as getting at the stores and stuff like that. The big volume stores don't make enough product for that, but the unique, like the cheese shop, the wine bars and stuff like that, that's where you get it out, get your product out. At least we do.
So then you wouldn't be able to find O'Neill Creek stuff at, say, a festival or a Gordy's yet?
Gordy's, yes. Okay. Jerry Schaefer. I think is one of his tenants to business is local, and a lot of their wine managers do that. But the cheese shops all the way, or the small liquor stores all the way from Menominee to Thorpe to Eau Claire or River Rice Lake, that's working for me.
So for you, were there any challenges that you didn't foresee when you got into this? And if someone wanted to ask you for some advice, say, hey, I want to start a winery, any pitfalls you'd try to have them avoid?
Well, it's all depends how much drive they have. There's a, you know, once everybody thinks wineries close up in the winter and stuff, but we're still fermenting 24/7, bottling. We just got done with bottling here in the end of January, and we'll be doing another one in April. And we're fermenting. Just start all over again. Or if you have a new a wine that you want to do, well, you test batches and stuff like that. So the customers can say, well, I like this, I like that, you know, and so.
And as far as the I don't know if the ATF gets involved with your operation or what, but as far as laws, permits, all that, was that a bit of a headache?
No, just like any product is out to the public. Yeah, we have a production room that has to be licensed. The water has to be checked. We're bonded federally and state. The whole gamut of stuff, just to make sure that the product is safe. And Trained Tobacco Bureau. Yeah, we do get inspected from them every so often. And, you know, they don't teach this stuff. They got a book this big. They don't have a class in it. So basically, once you get into the business and stuff, you get a lot of input from other wineries and stuff like that, that people that have went through that. And they do help out quite a bit, even all the way from Philippe at the Waldesheim, Von Steele and stuff. You get a lot of input from them to help you advance as far as your product.
So it's kind of like a community almost, the winemaking community?
Yeah, it's cool. Like I said, when we get to our associations and stuff, you ain't going to know unless you look at the label if they're big winery or small winery. Everybody's there to, you know, communicate and help each other.
And we were speaking a little bit before about distribution. And you have to distribute through a cooperative? That's the way the law is set up?
Yeah, that happened. I'm not quite sure if it was with your deal, but it happened where we have to belong to a co-op to wholesale our wine. So what they, whoever gets our wine, what retail store, they have to go pay the co-op, and then it's – to us. It's a tracking mechanism. Mm. So, and that's just a part, like I said, alcohol is highly regulated. That's just a part of it. And
it makes,
you learn to accept it. You don't like it, but you learn to accept it.
Well, I think, you know, regulation, it's a kind of a love-hate relationship with that in this country, but definitely for a purpose.
Yeah, make sure the product is good.
Right. So in 2009, I thought I remember Wisconsin passing a law allowing wineries to have distilleries if they so choose. Any thoughts about getting into the spirits market?
Not yet. A lot of wineries are doing it, but I don't have any plans. I just want to keep rolling along with what I do.
All right. Well, let's take our final break here, and we're talking about drinking locally, local wines, spirits, and beers. Plenty for the choosing in western Wisconsin and the state as a whole. We've heard so far from Joe Winimko and Lausch Frank. Joe is the vintner and co-owner of O'Neill Creek Winery in Bloomer, Wisconsin. Lausch is head brewer and co-owner of Lazy Monk Brewing in Eau Claire. We're going to hear from Paul Wernie next, and we'll still take some of your calls if we get them. We've got plenty of time. The number is 1-800-228-5615. Again, 800-228-5615. This is the West Side. We'll be back in just a bit. I'm Rich Kramer, and you're listening to The West Side on Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for tuning in. Thanks for joining us. We're talking about local breweries, local distilleries, local wineries, the drink local movement. Definitely a big, big growth in the industry as far as local craft alcohol is concerned in western Wisconsin and the state as a whole, nationwide, of course. If you'd like to join in the conversation, the number is 1-800-228-5615. I'm curious to find out from listeners what you prefer. Do you look local, or do you go for the national brands that might be less expensive and just something that you grew up with? Why do you pick what you pick? 800-228-5615. Now we're going to turn our attention to distilling, local distilling, craft distilling. We're going to hear from Paul Wernie. Paul, tell me about local distilling. It's not that it's new, but it seems like it's not taken off quite as much as especially the local brewing. So
it is new, actually.
It's new.
Yeah, in 2000, there were maybe 10 to 15 small distilleries in this country, and they were primarily in the wine regions, like maybe California or Michigan or New York. When we started up in 2007, there were about 30 to 40 small distilleries in this country, and there was nothing in the Midwest, really. There was, when we opened our doors, there was only one other distillery in Milwaukee, and they opened up 6 months before we did.
Hmm.
Now it's taking off. When they changed the laws in Wisconsin in 2009, they allowed us to have like a tasting room, and they allowed us to sell on site. And that had a big effect as far as cash flow goes into our facilities, and it made it more viable for more people. So now there's about 20 licenses in Wisconsin, and there's 14 planned distilleries in Minnesota. When we started up, there wasn't even a distillery in Washington State. Now there's 90 distilleries in Washington State.
Yikes.
There's a distillery opening up in this country, probably more than one every single week.
Hmm.
Yeah, so it is taking off right now.
You mentioned a law changed in 2009. Is it the same one that I was speaking about that let wineries get into distilling if they wanted?
Yeah, I believe so. I believe it was part of that. And that was really pushed by, with the help of some distribution companies in the Milwaukee and Madison area. And Great Lakes Distillery down in Milwaukee, the one that started up right before we did, they had a big effect in that one.
So why now? I mean, besides, you mentioned Wisconsin that had the law that kind of was like a springboard, but nationwide, I mean, why did it all happen at the same time?
Well, what happened was distilling is a little bit like brewing and winemaking. We kind of take both, but it's, distilling is treated differently. It's much more restricted by mm-hmm. the government. We have tighter laws. And so I think a lot of people just didn't think it could be done. And there were very few people doing it in 2000. And I think the community that was doing it was relatively tight-lipped. But then we had a distiller down in...
because of the federal liquor laws?
Well, I think they just didn't want anybody else in it.
Oh, okay.
But then you had a small distiller in Texas winning a national award or international award.
When was that?
That was in 2001.
Was that Tito's?
Yeah, that was Tito's. He won Best Vodka. He won double gold in San Francisco in 2001. And that's when I think they started writing more about it, started talking more about it, and then people like myself... We started wondering why it wasn't happening up here in the Midwest. And so I called the state of Wisconsin and said, why isn't anybody distilling in Wisconsin? And they said, I don't know. Nobody's thought about it, I guess.
Hmm.
And so by the time I opened up my door, there was another one running. And 6 months after I opened up, there was a distillery in Madison running.
So what got you to – what made you decide to get into distilling? I mean, we talked with Lausch and Joe that they – started with you know, home brewing, and were you home distilling? Or I imagine you don't want to say that on the air. If you were,
no, not really. I did some home brewing. My dad did some winemaking, and like I said, it's kind of a combination. If you're going to make a grain-based beer, like a whiskey or a vodka, you're basically making a beer and you're distilling it. If I was going to make a schnapps or a brandy, I'd make a wine and distill that. So it's a combination. I just wanted to do something creative. But on a manufacturing level, beer and wine are really fermentation centric, and distilling's a little bit more forgiving with that, and I wanted something more manufacturing also, and so that's where distilling was allowed me to do that.
So, had you always? You obviously weren't always in distilling. What did you do in your previous life?
I grew up in Wisconsin. I grew up in Merrill, Wisconsin, but then I went to school at the University of Minnesota, and I was living there. And my roommate in college, we started a business together, and it was actually a landscape construction business in the cities. And then my wife wanted a career, so she said, I work too much. So I said, I'll stay home with the kids. I sold my business, and fortunately I did it before the economy went down.
Mm-hmm.
And I sat around with the kids and waited and decided what to do next, and this is the first thing my wife agreed to.
That's a heck of a thing to agree to. I mean, was it a pretty big risk?
Well, you know,
or had yourself up?
Well, I had started a business before, and it was pretty successful, and so maybe I was perhaps a little bit more overconfident. I thought it would be, you know, it'd be easy. It was much more difficult to start this type of business because it was a relatively new industry, and we would go into places. Making the stuff is easy. It's selling it is the hard part, and it really wasn't that accepted at that time. It's really changed over the past year or two, and the reason why I believe is because of the opening of the brewing and the winemaking, especially in Minnesota, they changed their laws, and now there's brew pub explosion over there, or brewing explosion. And so now you have a lot of the consumers saying, hey, what about distilling?
Mm-hmm.
And now there's distilling opening up there. And plus, we're into our aged spirits right now. We're starting to release our whiskeys, and they've been sitting in barrels for years. And so that gives us some more credibility, too. So it's moving along pretty good now.
More credibility because, what, whiskey is America, basically?
I think there's a misconception that vodka is easy to make and all vodka is the same.
Sure.
Vodka is actually harder to make initially. It's harder to distill and harder to create. Whiskey distilling is actually relatively simple. The hard part about whiskey is sticking in a barrel and waiting for it. And then the expensive part about whiskey is when you open up that barrel, you lost a lot of what you put in there. And so...
Mm.
If you have the patience to wait several years for your whiskeys to mature, you can have a nice spirit. And then a lot of the beer drinkers, they're not looking for vodka. The beer drinkers are looking for an aged spirit and a brown spirit.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have all these guys that are really into these small local beers that are looking for small local whiskeys. And that's where the credibility comes in too.
Sure. So what kind of products do you guys have? I know 45th Parallel is pretty well known for a vodka.
Yes.
What else?
Well, there's a lot of things we make. We make three different types of whiskeys. We make a bourbon style whiskey, a rye whiskey, and a wheat style whiskey. And we make aquavits. But that's a contract. We don't own that brand, so we make three different types of whiskeys. I mean, aquavits. One's a dill aquavits, unaged. And then we have a celebration, which is slightly aged. And a holiday, that's Aged about a year and use sherry cask from a winery that near the border.
And for people that might not know what that is, what is aquavit? And well, I think you've explained it to me before as a gin for Scandinavians.
Yeah, we make a gin too, and our gin is well received, especially in the Madison area. But you make an aquavit exactly the same way you'd make a gin, but gin is juniper based, or it's heavy on the juniper, whereas aquavit is caraway. And you can substitute some of the caraway for dill. So it's the exact same process, so that's why I say it's gin for Scandinavians.
That reminds me, I got an email early this morning. It might have been just late last night, one or the other, but it's the first thing I saw this morning from John Thorpe. He's in Eau Claire. He says he takes the aquavit, the Gamaleod dill aquavit, freezes it in a block of ice, and then pours shots that are chased by sliced cucumbers sprinkled with sea salt.
I'd like him to email that recipe to me. That sounds kind of cool.
That does sound cool, yeah. And so where are your products go as far as are they sold in local stores? You mentioned that was the tough part. Is yours like Lazy Monk where a lot of the business is through the tasting room?
No. I would say two-thirds of our business is wholesale or contract, and one-third of our business was retail out of our business. But that's changing. I think our wholesale is going to overtake it dramatically this year. And that has a lot to do with us having a salesperson that can go out there and spend time talking to people. We never had that before. Mm-hmm. We were just finally got to the size where I hired somebody, and he's full-time, and that's what he does. And just getting in front of people and talking to them is a big deal.
So if you were living in the Twin Cities prior to starting up this distillery in New Richmond, why did you not build it in the Twin Cities?
Well, at that time, Minnesota had a $30,000 annual permit fee for distilling, whereas Wisconsin's permit fee is $1,000. And another neighbor state, Iowa, is $500. So really, you could not start a small distillery in Minnesota at the time. Minnesota was one of the last states to actually get a distillery. They were one of two that didn't have one up till like 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. But they since have lowered the fee. They lowered it to about $2,000 a year. And now there's, like I said, there's 14 planned distilleries. There's three already running in that state, and there's 10 or 11 more planned.
Okay, so then Wisconsin obviously made more economical sense. So for you, what kind of what are the hurdles like as far as federal, state, local, et cetera?
Well, I think a lot of the hurdles are the same as what a brewery or winery would go through. The only thing is we're just a little bit more restricted, and it costs more for us because we deal with high-proof alcohol, and it makes a lot of money for the government. They're really interested in net revenue, so
we haven't even talked about that yet. As far as taxes that go into how can you quantify that for someone at home that might not realize what you're actually paying to?
Well, a typical liter of vodka would generate about $2.80 in federal tax just right off the bat once it leaves my building. Mm-hmm. And then in Wisconsin, another 90 cents to the state of Wisconsin. So that's a fair amount of money for that one bottle of vodka.
Right. And Lausch, for brewing, what kind of taxes? I mean, fair taxes or overly taxed? Let's.
Oh, it's fair tax.
I'm sorry. There you go.
It's only fair tax.
Okay, of course. So how do you quantify that for people at home? Like, is it by the bottle or by the gallon?
Actually, the beer is measured by the barrel, and it's 31 gallons. And there is for small breweries, there is a $7 per barrel federal tax, and $1 for breweries Wisconsin tax.
Okay. Any idea what it is, neighboring states at all?
Federal is always the same. I think Minnesota was like $2.40 a barrel, and I don't know farther.
Okay. And Joe, he's looking like he's crunching some numbers right now.
Federal is $1.37 a gallon, and then the small winery discount, it goes down to $1.07.
Okay.
And then I think the state is 63, I think. The computer does all the figuring from gallons to liters.
So was it more or less than you would have expected when you got into it, or did you just kind of build it into your process?
It built into the process. You know, when you buy a bottle of wine, it's built in.
Okay.
So,
all right, and Paul, you know, everyone, well, people buy beer, people buy wine, people buy spirits as well, but I mean, I guess where does the majority of your stuff go? Is it going into homes or restaurants, bars?
The majority sold at liquor stores. I mean, you want to be in the restaurants and into the bars because that's where people kind of learn about new products. However, their shelf space is limited. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes it's hard to get a bottle of vodka on there because it's easier to get into a liquor store. What opens doors for us right now are aged spirits. Unfortunately, we don't have a lot of them. We only release probably around $700 bottles a month in just aged whiskey. But it's starting to – it depends on what part of the market it is. We're starting to expand into Minnesota quite a bit now. And some of our more discounted spirits, we have a Midwest line that's – actually, almost all of it sells in the Madison area for some reason. Hmm. And I think that's mainly because a couple of well-known places in the square carry it as their rail. And so then people see it there. And then it ends up at like Woodman's or it ends up at Trader Joe's. And we're selling 90% of that Midwest line down in that Madison area.
Huh. So as far as alcohol or spirits, liquor, hard liquor is concerned, where does most of it come from, and what differentiates what you do to, say, Phillips or Seagram's or something like that?
Well, I mentioned that a third of our business is contract work. What that means is we make spirits for other companies.
Okay.
So I make aquavits for another company. I make a horseradish vodka for a company. I make bourbon in bulk for another company. And that's really the distilled spirits industry. There's about a handful of large facilities in this country that make almost all the spirits. And these spirits are loaded up in tanker cars and they're shipped around the country where they're purchased and then they're processed and bottled at those facilities.
So we're talking raw alcohol leaves from a handful of...
Yeah. There's, like I said, there's five or six of them in this country that make 90% of the alcohol, and they're shipped all over the country.
And people haven't heard of them?
Yeah, national, huge brands that I don't want to mention. But that they really start at the same facilities. They come out of these facilities as a neutral spirit, about 190 proof, and then they're processed and bottled at those facilities, and then they have their label on them.
Processed meaning what? Infusing or adding... chemicals to it?
Yeah, well, they could be infused. They could be adding stabilizers or sweeteners, flavoring, coloring. They're blended down to their bottling spirit because they're probably at 190 proof when they buy them, but then they have to maybe blend them down to 80 proof or whatever proof that they're bottling at.
That's by law? Or?
Yeah. Well, yeah, if you have a vodka has to be 80 proof. So you're going to have to add water to it. And some, if you're going to be blending it into maybe a liqueur, and you're probably going to be at a lower proof than that. So you're going to add a simple syrup and some more water.
Hmm. Listeners, we've got time to take one or two more, probably just one more call. If you give us a ring, 800-228-5615. We're talking local drinking locally, local beer, wine, spirits here on the west side. We've got Leos Frank of Lazy Monk Brewing, Joe Winimko, vintner and co-owner of O'Neill Creek Winery, and Paul Werney, co-owner of 45th Parallel Distillery, 800-228-5615. So, Paul, there's a show that's been on Discovery Channel, something I think it's called Moonshiners, but basically they track these guys that are in the woods of West Virginia or something, and they're making their moonshine. You know, sometimes they infuse it, make some brandy, whatever. What is that? What is your thought about, what do you think when you're watching a show like that, or do you even bother?
I get asked that every week. Somebody comes to the building and asks me if I watch those shows, and no, I watched about 5-10 minutes of one, and I that was enough for me.
Yeah.
It's just not it's not reality, for me at least.
Why? What do you mean?
I don't know. they're not doing the profession any favors.
Sure.
Just put it that way.
But they do talk a little bit about, well, going legal costs a lot of money, and maybe you could attest to that.
The difference between legal and not legal is paying taxes. And yes, we do pay a lot of taxes, but that's where the money is.
Okay. All right, well, we've got one call that we're going to try to squeeze in right now. In just a bit here, we've got... All right, we got Steve and Eau Claire. You're on the air, Steve. Thanks so much for calling.
Archer Daniels owns most of the distilleries in the country, but what I'm curious about is where in Eau Claire is Lazy Monk? I want to go over there and try some of their... beer.
Sounds good. Steve, what about it, Lausch? Where are you at?
We are located at 320 Putnam Street. That is the old Wholesome Bakery. It's by the Banbury Place.
Got it.
All right.
Good to know.
Thanks so much for calling in.
Thank you.
Hey, thanks.
And real quick, gentlemen, I'm going to go round robin again, and I've got to ask this because Henry, our producer, he demands it. So not everybody drinks alcohol. In fact, there are a lot who might believe that it's kind of a curse on humanity. So let me ask this. Do you feel like you're contributing to the downfall of society? I'll start with Lausch first.
Not necessarily.
Not necessarily. Paul?
We just spice it up a little bit.
Just spice it up? All right. And Joe, what's your thoughts?
It's a social – mine's a social drink. It's laid back and it is what it is, you know, as far as I don't think I'm contributing to it, because most of the people that do walk out of our doors are happy and not overly inebriated.
There you go. It's a personal choice. Let's leave it at that. Gentlemen, thank you so much for the discussion. That's our time. My guests, Paul Wernie is the co-owner of 45th Parallel Distillery. Joe Winimko is the co-owner of O'Neill Creek Winery. And Lausch Frank is head brewer and co-owner of Lazy Monk Brewing in Eau Claire. Gentlemen, thanks so much. A good discussion. Also, big thanks to Team Westside, including Mort Cypress, who handled on-air production, Tiffany Coggins for promotions, and Dean Collenbeck for keeping our ducks in a row. Tune in next week as guest host Dean Collenbeck looks into issues facing rural school districts, and they are many. Until then, thanks for listening. Have a happy and productive week, and we'll chat again Monday morning.